Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts. Each week at this time, H.J. Heinz Company, makers of the famous 57 varieties, gives you information, please. A quartet of experts is on hand to answer your questions. Send them to Information Please at 570 Lexington Avenue, New York 22, New York. We may edit them a bit, and in case of similarity, you'll have to accept our judgment of who shall be paid. If we use your question, the H.J. Heinz Company will send $10 in war stamps, plus a copy of the Encyclopedia Britannica World Atlas. If we muff the question, you get $57 in war bonds and stamps, plus a 24-volume set of the regular Encyclopedia Britannica. All questions remain our property. Information, Please is presented under the supervision of Dan Golenpohl. And now, our master of ceremonies, Clifton Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, Information, Please, happy-go-lucky and fresh as the breeze. Gosh, a rhyme, Mr. Adams. Continues tonight on its merry way, presenting as its experts John Kieran of the New York Sun, Franklin P. Adams, and as its special guests, Christopher Morley, essayist and novelist, and to celebrate the reopening of Congress, one of the representatives from the state of Washington, the Honorable John M. Coffey. Mr. Coffey, you have an edible name. Are you the only one in Congress that has an edible name, rationed or unrationed?
No, Mr. Fadiman, there are quite a number of others. If you'd like me to give you a few samples.
Well, could you make up a menu for us?
Well, there's T-Bone, senator from the state of Washington. There's
That's
Pepper.
Hilarious.
We have Seller in the House from New York. We could go with Pepper. We don't have a salt cellar. We could use him as a pepper cellar. We have wheat in the house.
Wheat?
And hare, H-A-R-E, in the house.
Oh, that's what comes in the soup. Mr. Adams?
And Mr. Fish.
Yes, there is Mr. Fish. Matter of fact, his first name is...
Mr. Ham.
Mr. Ham Fish. It's a delicious Congress we have. Well, let's start with a question that comes from Helen E. Chandler of Brookline, Pennsylvania. And she wants to know what the circumstances were that prompted the writing of each of these bits of verse. I'm going to read you the bits of verse. Each of them is connected with some historical circumstance. We're going to get two out of three if we can. Here's the first. Teddy, come home and blow your horn. The sheep's in the meadow, the cow's in the corn. Mr. Adams.
Little Boy Blue.
Well, that's not exactly Little Boy Blue. It's a reminiscence of Little Boy Blue. Mr. Morley?
There was when Theodore Roosevelt was in Africa and the political parties were getting out of hand over here.
That's right. He wanted him to come home and blow your horn. The sheep's in the meadow, the cow's in the corn. Now, does it...
not the corn belt, of course.
No, not the corn belt. When was this about, Mr. Morley?
Oh, about 19...
What did you say, Mr. Adams?
1910.
Yes. 1909 to 1910. Quite right. Now, here's another bit of verse. What was the circumstance that prompted this one? We don't want to fight, but by jingo, if we do, we've got the ships, we've got the men, and we've got the money, too. Used to be famous four lines. Mr. Morley.
That was in the era of Palmerston in Great Britain when there was a good deal of talk about possibly going to the rescue of Turkey, the sick man of Europe, and fighting with the Russians.
Yes.
This was the origin of the term jingoism.
That's the origin of the term jingoism. It was a famous music hall song of the period, and people still quote it. Now, here's another bit of verse, rather two bits of verse from the same longer poem. Why don't you ask me what I did when I was in the war? They told me that each little kid would surely ask me what I did. That's one part. And then later on in the same poem come these verses. I've had my story ready for 30 years or more. Don't bother, Grandpa, said the child. I find such things a bore. Mr. Adams.
No, that part I don't know.
You don't
know? It sounds as though I wrote it.
I try to make it sound as good as possible. You did write it, Mr. Adams. When did you write it?
After the World War One.
Yeah, and what were you,
it was a parody on the Battle of Blenheim.
Yeah, and what were you trying to sort of figure out in this poem? Remember what the poem was called?
Something about Little Wilhelmine.
It was a famous victory. It's a parody of as you said,
Battle of Blenheim.
Battle of Blenheim, and you were trying to foresee the reactions in 1919, the reactions in 1944. I hate to point all this out to you, Mr. Adams.
I was wrong, maybe.
Maybe you were wrong. However, you got the question right. And that gives us 3 out of 3 and sends us on to this one from Robert Friedlander of Leonardo, New Jersey. Give the terminal dates, the beginning and end, involved in each of these historical periods or occasions.
The Seven Years' War. What were the dates of the Seven Years' War? Let's see whether I remember any. Mr. Cuffey.
1756 to 1763.
That's right. And by gollys, if you count them, that works out to just 7 years. Darndest coincidence. What was the Seven Years' War, Mr. Cuffey? In a word or two?
Well, over in this country, it was a war between France and Great Britain for the possession of Canada and French America.
Yes, and over on the other side of the world? France and Austria against England and Prussia. And what was the general result of the war, what would you say? Who came out top dog?
Well, the English and their allies came out top dog.
Yes, that's right.
It started Pittsburgh.
Yes, if you want to, hadn't thought
it's
of it.
Important on this program.
True. I hadn't thought of it. Started Pittsburgh. My God. What a tactful man you are, Mr. Morley. You owe Pittsburgh the 7 Years' War? Maybe it was worthwhile fighting it. How about the 100 days? Can you date them, the 100 days? Mr. Kieran.
March 1st, 1815 to June 15th. June 18th, 1815.
You're a tiny bit out, Mr. Kieran. Mr. Coffey, do you want to correct Mr. Kieran? It's a dangerous thing to do.
If he's referring to Waterloo, I was going to refer to June 18th, 1815.
Mr. Morley?
It's a little earlier than that. It refers to Napoleon's absence in Elba.
Yeah?
And Napoleon came back by sometime in May, didn't he?
March 1st, he debarked on the coast of France.
Now, he arrived in Paris March 20th.
Yes, but he debarked on the coast of France on March 1st. You will find that opening a chapter in Les Miserables by Hugo.
And if you add 100 days to March 1st...
No, the 100 days doesn't figure out exactly anywhere.
Oh, that's the trouble, see. It does figure out if you say March 20th, 1815, to June 28th, when Louis XVIII returned. And I think that's what the 100 days are, March 20th to June 28th. But, on the other hand, Mr. Kieran, if you want to take it up with the heirs of Napoleon, well, go right ahead. The last man in the world to say nay to it. How about the Diamond Jubilee? What is the Diamond Jubilee? Mr. Morley.
1897, the 60th anniversary of Queen Victoria's accession to the throne.
That's correct. And if you count 60 years back, you get?
37.
37. 1837 to 1897, the Jubilee in celebration, 60 years of Queen Victoria's reign. And how about this one for Mrs. Ralph Russo of Minneapolis? What character, fact or fiction, is associated with each of these banks? There are three of them. See if we can get two out of three. The first is Tellson's Bank. Tellson's Bank, Mr. Kieran.
Mr. Jarvis Lorry.
Who was he?
Well, he was one of the agents of Tellson's Bank, which is in The Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens.
Yes, that's right. Is there any other character in that novel that you associate with
the bank? Yes, that is the man who fishes at midnight in a cemetery, beginning with a spade. He had a son, too.
Do you remember everything about him but his name?
Yes.
Anyone remember his name, Mr. Adams? Jerry Cruncher was
Jerry
his name.
Cruncher.
Jerry Cruncher. Very good name for him. How about the Northfield Bank? When I say the Northfield Bank, does that bring anything to mind? Well, Mrs. Russell, who sent this in, comes from Minnesota, and the Northfield Bank is where? Mr. Adams? Mr. Coffey?
Might be in Minnesota. Minnesota.
Northfield.
Northfield. Right. And what happened there? Any idea, Mr. Kieran?
Isn't that Sauk Center Bank?
No. Now you're guessing.
Yeah.
Jesse James. Jesse James tried unsuccessfully to rob the bank in Northfield, Minnesota. Remember, two of his followers were caught, and Jesse and Frank got away. At least that's the story as we learned it.
He robbed so many banks.
This was a very special one. How about the Coburg Branch of the City and Suburban Bank? The Coburg Branch of the City and Suburban Bank. Do I get a blank on that, Mr. Morley?
Well, that's where John Clay, the second most dangerous man in London, was lurking in the cellar when Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson turned up with the bank manager and discovered him.
Of course, it's perfect.
And the story of the Red-Headed League.
In the story of the Red-Headed League by Conan Doyle, that's right. Any of you others Conan Doyle fans?
No.
Not yet. Mr. Kieran?
Mm-hmm.
Do you bow your head in shame before Mr. Morley's superior knowledge?
I do.
Very good. That sends us on to this question from Mrs. John D. Cook of Montpelier, Indiana. Can you identify these national elections from the vice presidential candidates? The first set of candidates, vice presidential candidates, Thomas R. Marshall and Charles W. Fairbanks. What national election do they figure in, Mr. Coffey?
1912, Woodrow Wilson and his Republican opponent.
Well, it's so long ago, you can name them now. I don't think that's right, though. Mr. Kieran.
I think it was 16, wasn't it?
I think it was, yes. It was the Wilson-Hughes campaign in which Marshall and Fairbanks ran. Mr. Kieran is right on that, but came in just a little too late. How about Charles G. Dawes and Charles W. Bryan? Charles, Mr. Coffey?
1924.
That's right. And who were the presidential candidates then?
In 1924, the candidate on the Democratic ticket was John W. Davis.
That's right.
And on the Republican ticket, it was Calvin Coolidge.
Calvin Coolidge. That's quite right. Now, here's another set of vice presidential candidates, Charles Curtis and Joseph T. Robinson. What campaign did they figure in? Mr. Adams.
Charles Curtis was vice president under Mr. Hoover.
That's quite right. And what campaign would that have been then, Mr. Adams?
That would have been 1928.
That's right. And the Democratic opponent in that election was, Mr. Coffey?
Al Smith.
Al Smith, yes. Well, we seem to do pretty well on that one. Here's one from Albert A. Golub of Fall River, Massachusetts. Ben Jonson once said that Shakespeare knew little Latin and less Greek.
Small Latin.
Small Latin and less Greek? On this card, it says he knew little Latin and less Greek.
Wrong.
I'm sure that's wrong. How about this? In The Merry Wives of Windsor, there's a scene in which a schoolmaster, whose name is Evans, but that doesn't matter, quizzes a little boy to see how much Latin he knows. And do you think you can do as well as the little boy with these questions, which are now drawn from that famous scene in The Merry Wives of Windsor? The first question is, what is the word fair in Latin? F-A-I-R, meaning beautiful. Mr. Heron?
Pulcair.
Pulcair is quite right. Well, you've done as well as the little quiz kid so far, Mr. Heron. How about lapis? What is lapis in English? Lapis, Mr. Morley.
A stone.
A stone, quite right. And finally, gentlemen, what is the genitive case plural of hic, hike, hoke? Genitive plural, Mr. Coffey.
You said plural. I was thinking of huius.
Oh, I want the plural. Mr. Morley.
Horum, harum, horum.
That's quite right. Horum, harum, horum. Very good, yes. The boy got them all right in the play. He was named William, undoubtedly after the man who created him. Very bright little boy. How about this? Or rather, here's a completely practical question which I'd like to ask of our Heinz reporter, Ben Grauer. Ben, what has been the effect of last summer's shortage of farm labor on present supplies of canned food?
Matter of fact, our supplies of many canned foods, notably baby foods, have been affected less than you'd expect. Certainly, there was a very real shortage of labor last summer, and there might have been a whole lot less of Heinz baby foods on the market right now if it hadn't been for community spirit, for down-to-earth patriotism that saved the day. In the rich farm country around Medina, New York, and in several other communities where Heinz branch factories are located, many of the townspeople, doctors, lawyers, professors, club women, volunteered to help in the fields and harvest the crops. There were boys and girls of high school age. There were Heinz salesmen and their wives, too. They all got together and worked like beavers. And let me tell you, these patriotic citizens saved prize crops that made it possible for Heinz to prepare millions of fine meals for America's babies. And we're glad to have this opportunity to pay tribute to them tonight.
Thank you, Ben Grauer. By the way, it just occurs to me that Mrs. Cook's question about the vice presidential candidates was really wrongly answered. Mr. Kieran came in with the right answer just a second too late, so that sends $57 in war bonds and stamps to Mrs. Cook and a set of the Britannica. Now try this one, gentlemen, from Sergeant Joseph L. Thibodeau of Boston. Name the famous treaties or pacts of history that were signed in these places. What one was signed in a field? In a field. Famous pact of history that was signed in an open field. For example, Mr. Coffey.
Well, I don't know whether you mean that. Mean what I'm thinking of, and that is the field of Runnymede.
I am indeed.
Magna Carta, 1215.
Yes. That's quite right, yes. Why should you be so apologetic about it?
Well, I thought you had in mind a treaty between two countries.
Well, it was a pact, wasn't it?
Yes,
between
it was
two
pact.
Groups in England. And what, in a word, what would you say the significance of the Magna Carta might have been?
It was the beginning of the establishment of civil rights for the commoners of England.
Yes.
That's what it laid the groundwork for subsequent constitutions.
Quite right, and from it, from that old document, we draw part of our own Charter of Liberties. And how about a famous treaty that was signed on a ship? Oh, there might be two answers for this one. A famous pact or treaty or agreement that was signed on a ship. Mr. Kieran.
Winston Churchill and President Roosevelt issued the Charter of the Four Freedoms on a battleship.
Well, it was called what? The Atlantic Charter.
Atlantic
Charter, rather. Signed on the USS Augusta in 1941. And rather a longer time ago, there was an equally famous compact signed on a ship named what? What was the... Mr. Morley.
The Mayflower.
Yes, the Mayflower Compact. The famous Mayflower Compact of the Pilgrims in 1620. What famous treaty was signed in a navy yard? Signed, Mr. Compey.
1905, the end of the war with Japan and Russia, signed at Portsmouth.
Yes, Portsmouth, right up here in New Hampshire. And who was generally given considerable credit for establishing that
treaty? Theodore Roosevelt was given the, that Swedish prize, the...
The Nobel Prize?
Nobel Prize,
yes.
For peace.
For being certainly partly instrumental in getting...
Wasn't that actually signed at that corny old summer hotel there, not in the Navy Yard?
The Hotel Wentworth.
Yeah.
Is that so?
I never heard of it being signed actually in the Navy Yard.
I've been told it was signed in the Navy Yard now for year after year. Now you pop up with this hotel, Mr. Morley. Are you out to upset all the history
books? I remember pictures of it in Collier's when I was a small boy. Pictures of the rocking chairs, still rocking after the Baron Whitty got out of it.
You realize, of course, that you're contradicting a congressman when you say that it wasn't signed in the Navy Yard. I'll take either the rocking chair or the Navy Yard as the answer. And go on to this question from Miss Grace Knobel of Evanston, Illinois. Each of the following is the assistant to a greater rascal or villain than he is. In other words, I want you to name the chief rascal. I'll give you the assistants. Let's get two out of three. The first is Colonel Sebastian Moran. Colonel Sebastian Moran. I guess you either know this or you don't, and Mr. Morley knows it.
Professor Moriarty.
Who was Professor Moriarty, Mr. Morley?
He was the king of crime in the days of Sherlock Holmes.
Yes,
Head of the great crime ring in London.
Yeah. Well, where do you find Colonel Sebastian Moran appearing in which of the stories?
In The Adventure of the Empty House.
Adventure of the Empty House. And who outwits him? By golly,
Mr. Holmes.
Mr. Holmes, yes. How about Jack Dawkins? He was attached to a greater rascal than himself. Jack Dawkins, D-A-W-K-I-N-S. Here again, you either know it or you don't. Mr.
Was that the James boys?
No, I just put that in your mind a couple of minutes ago with that question about
some
James
Western hijacker.
Not very Western. Matter of fact, more Eastern, East End of London. Mr. Cure?
No.
Why, Mr. Adams, is that your hand?
No.
Floating
no.
Lazily up and down? It's Fagin in Oliver Twist. Remember, Dawkins was the Artful Dodger. I guess you'd know him by that name. And Mr. Big, the big Mr. Villain was... Mr. Big Villain was Mr. Fagin in Oliver Twist. And the third one, I think, is much easier than that, and that's Roderigo. How about Roderigo? Who is the Mr. Kieran?
He was an accomplice of Iago in Othello.
Yes, and what is the relation between Roderigo and
Iago?
Oh,
he was a stooge, as a matter of fact.
Oh, yes. How does Iago use him in the play?
Iago uses him to provoke Cassio into a scrap in which Cassio is disgraced and thrown out of office, and then he gets the office.
Right. That gives us two out of three and passes us on to this one from Ruth L. Burning of Cincinnati, Ohio. This is an interesting question, gentlemen. I'm going to give you some of the important chemical constituents of various cosmetics used by a lady, unnamed here, who is getting dressed. You are to tell me just what she is using. For example, or rather, try this one. If the constituents of the cosmetic are steatite, cornflour, and magnesia, what is she doing, Mr. Adams?
She is powdering.
She is powdering, yes. Those are the constituents of ordinary talcum powder, would you say?
Ordinary talcum powder or something more costly.
or bath powder, yes. Now, suppose the constituents of the cosmetic are petroleum jelly, white wax, spermaceti, and an emulsifier. Mr. Cuffy?
Lipstick.
No, you're off the beam. Mr. Morley.
I should say cold cream.
Cold cream, yes, that's right. Very good, Mr. Morley. How'd you know that?
I heard about it.
Very good. Now, suppose the ingredients or constituents are something called sericene, which I'm no doubt mispronouncing, cholesterol, wax, carmine, cocoa butter, and castor oil. You put them all together and you get what, Mr. Adams?
Lipstick.
Ah, yes. Mr. Adams, you're very good at this. You certainly have been
I'm not
around.
Guessing either.
How about this one from Kay McGregor of Los Angeles, California. What form of literature literally means something made? In other words, if you take Mr. Morley.
Poetry.
That's quite right. What does it go back to in etymologically?
The Greek word poieo, meaning to make.
To make, yes, quite right. A thing made. We rarely think of that because most of us, including myself, don't know it. How about a form of literature that literally means stuffing or filling? Mr. Molly.
Satire.
I don't think it means stuffing.
Satura was a sort of a sausage or stuffed bladder, wasn't it?
No, you're skirting the edge of it, but you haven't got it quite right. The stuffing or filling is a farce from the French.
Farce,
right, Miss Sharon?
Farce.
Meaning to stuff. They use it in cooking now.
That's right.
Yes. Now I'm going to come back to you, Mr. Morley. I'm going to ask you to tell us what form of literature literally means full of food or sated or satisfied or replete.
Well, isn't that a form of stuffing?
Yes, it is.
That's satire.
That's satire, yes. And what's the word it comes from, that it comes from?
Satura.
Satura, which originally meant...
Which means just about the same in Greek as Farsi does in...
Something like it. It was a kind of a dish of mixed food, of which perhaps you could get too much. And now let's hear from that expert of the trencher, that digger up of esoteric lore on food, our Heinz reporter, Ben Grauer.
Well, tonight I have a honey of a quotation. Listen. Where the grass is fresh and fine, pretty cow, go there and dine. Now, that's a perfectly good quotation from a 19th century poem, The Cow, by Ann Taylor. And there's a perfectly good and scientific reason for quoting it when we talk about Heinz foods for babies. For we know now that the place where a cow dines, the kind of grass she eats, has an important bearing upon the vitamin content of baby's milk. We also have definite proof that the vitamin value of a vegetable is affected by the soil in which it grows. One carrot may look like any other carrot, but the carrot with the proper environment will provide a whole lot more in the way of vitamins and minerals. And that's one reason H.J. Heinz Company has always paid so much attention to the selection of farmland. Why, did you know that every leaf of spinach, every carrot, beet, or string bean that goes into Heinz baby foods has been specially grown under the supervision of Heinz's own agricultural experts and rushed at its peak of flavor from the fields to the kitchen? Well, these are things you don't really have to be told. For in all of Heinz's 57 varieties, you can taste quality. And let me tell you, it tastes fine.
Thank you, Ben Grauer. Gentlemen, try this one from Ruth Holmesbane of Cleveland, Ohio. I'm going to name three battles, three famous battles. I want you to tell us who attacked, whether there was a counterattack, and which side won. In other words, three items of information, and the first battle is Saint Mihiel. M-I-H-I-E-L. Saint-Mihiel, Mr. Kieran. Who attacked first?
The Americans attacked Saint-Mihiel in about September 12th, 1918.
Good enough.
The Germans did not reattack at the point.
That's quite
they
right.
They retreated.
That's quite right. Drove the Germans back so that the battle was won by us. That's exactly right, Mr. Kieran. How near were you to that battle at the time?
Well, too close at times.
You still think so? How about the Battle of Gettysburg? Who attacked? Was there a counterattack, and which side won? Mr. Coffey, care to enlighten us on that?
I know when it occurred, July the 1st to the 3rd, 1863. It was between George Gordon Meade on the Union side and...
Yes?
And Robert E. Lee on the Confederate side.
That's exactly right, Mr. Coffey. Now, who did the attacking in the famous Battle of Gettysburg? Mr. Adams?
The Confederates.
The Confederate Army attacked, and then what happened? I don't know whether you were an eyewitness at the time, but
I read it and long remember.
And a very good place to read the account of that battle, Mr. Kieran.
I think the whole thing lasted 3 days.
Yes,
and the Confederates couldn't turn the position. The Union Army had a strong ridge that they couldn't be turned from. And on the third day, when after Pickett's charge had been gone over and all that, well, they finally had to retreat because they couldn't stand down there and take the fire from this ridge.
Yes, but was there a counterattack on the Union side?
Oh, the Union drove. Yeah. Finally, the Confederates quit the field under the fire of the...
Yes, but there was no counterattack on the part of the Union side. General Meade, as a matter of fact, failed to follow up the advantage, which perhaps he had at the time, and so the battle is ordinarily put down as a Union victory. How about... Jytomyr. Who attacked? Was there a counterattack? And which side won? Jytomyr?
I recognize the word.
That's because I pronounced it in such a way as to confuse you, but not Mr. Morley. Mr. Morley, the eminent Russian expert.
Jytomyr was first taken, but only for a day or so, I think, by General Vatutin's Russian Central Army. And then the Germans counterattacked.
Correct.
And the Russians were driven back and
correct.
Have only just recaptured it after an interval of about 6 weeks of just lately recaptured
Jytomyr.
But what is extremely exciting to me, they also captured what lies just below Zeta Mir, buried itself, the birthplace of Joseph Conrad.
Is that so? That's very interesting.
I've been waiting for one of the papers to mention it.
Well, they will from now on, maybe. How about this one? That gives us a 3 out of 3. Try this one for Mrs. Charles McCain of Birmingham, Alabama. What character in Shakespeare contributes each line of the following synthetic stanza? It's made up of 4 lines drawn from different plays and different characters. To bed, put out the light. To sleep, good night, good night. Now, the first line is to bed, where would you find that in Shakespeare? Who says the line? To bed. Mr. Kieran, I can...
Was that in Macbeth?
It is indeed. I can see the whole play going through your mind, practically. Who says the line?
Either Macbeth or Mrs. Macbeth.
Choose one.
Well, I'll say Mrs. Macbeth.
That's a safe choice, yes. Lady Macbeth.
And put out the light as Othello.
Put out the light is Othello. He says it himself.
Put out the light and then put out the light.
Yes. And what is he referring to at the time?
Going to murder Desdemona.
Yes, one of the most chilling lines in Shakespeare. And now the third line is to sleep. To sleep. Who says that? Mr. Kieran?
Mr. Hamlet says that.
Where does he say it? Apropos of what?
To sleep, to dream.
To sleep, to dream.
Yes, perchance to dream, I guess he says.
Perchance to dream.
Right, and that famous soliloquy. And finally, we have good night, contributed by what Shakespearean character? Good night, Mr. Morley?
Good night, sweet prince. Is that the...
That's one
good night. We've got to get 2 of them. Mr. Kieran?
Good night, that is Juliet, I believe, or Romeo.
No, I don't think so. No. Yes, it is. You're quite right, Mr. Kieran. Juliet, good night, parting is such sweet sorrow.
I could say good night until tomorrow.
And isn't there another, quite right, and isn't there another good night in Hamlet? Good night, ladies, good night, sweet ladies, good night, good night.
Yes, that's Ophelia.
That's Ophelia, yes. Well, that gives us 4 Shakespearean characters making up that synthetic stanza. And that's all we'll have time for. Thank you, Mr. Coffey and Mr. Morley, for coming to bat for us this evening. Tonight, the H.J. Hines Company has paid out $57 in war bonds and stamps and 1 set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Next week, Mr. Kieran, Mr. Adams, and Mr. Levant will be on hand, and our guest will be the novelist who has given us the outstanding bestseller of the season, So Little Time, Mr. J.P. Marquand. Remember, send your questions and the correct answers to information, please, 5... 5-